Hello and welcome to another episode of Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. This year, The Conduit has partnered with the Johnson & Johnson Center for Health Worker Innovation to create a podcast series that explores the meaning of care in different communities around the world. From physicians to directors, community workers to advocates, we will be talking to individuals on the ground to discover answers to the question, what is the point of care? In today's episode, I will be talking to Corey Feist and Stephanie Simmons. Corey is a healthcare executive with over 20 years of experience and is the co-founder of the Dr. Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation. He also served as the chief executive officer of the University of Virginia Physicians Group, a medical group of more than 1,200 physicians and advanced practice providers. Corey has authored numerous publications on the need to support the well-being of the healthcare workforce. Dr. Stephanie Simmons is a board-certified emergency medicine physician with over 15 years of clinical practice. She focuses on the research, development, and implementation of programs designed to strengthen the relational skills of clinicians, enhance professional well-being among clinicians, and engage teams in the practice of medicine. Welcome, Corey and Stephanie. So today we're going to be talking about the mental health of the health workforce in the United States. And Corey, you first, can you tell me about the All-In Well-Being First for Healthcare campaign and also about the Dr. Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation and what inspired both the campaign and their beginnings?
Sure. And let me start by saying thank you for having us today. It's wonderful to be here with you, and I want to thank the listeners for paying attention to this really important issue that impacts healthcare workers from the United States, but also beyond. Some of the things we'll talk about today are specific to the United States, but others are very much span the globe. In April of 2021, we created an initiative called All In Wellbeing First for Healthcare at the Dr. Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation, which I'm the president of. And we did that with a number of United States-based organizations that span the healthcare industry, from physicians to nurses to hospitals and beyond. We created this initiative that is focused in two primary areas. First, scaling solutions to support the well-being of the healthcare workforce, heavily focused on systems and operational drivers that create burnout and other detrimental conditions for the healthcare workforce. And the second goal is to eliminate barriers to mental health access that apply to licensed health workers, such as nurses and physicians, in the United States, and removing them. That work was created just under a year after we had created our foundation itself, which is named after my sister-in-law, Dr. Lorna Breen, who died by suicide in April of 2020 and was the medical director of the emergency department in New York City in the New York Presbyterian Health System called the Allen Hospital. And it was a very busy hospital at the peak of the pandemic or the beginnings of the pandemic in March of 2020. And Lorna's story made national news really within 12 hours of her passing by suicide. This was a 49-year-old physician at the top of her game, really living her dream to be an emergency medicine physician, having been schooled in Ivy League schools and even going back in the process of getting her MBA. She was overwhelmed by the experience and obtained her first ever mental health treatment in the United States. And only after receiving that mental health treatment, started to express serious concerns about the impact of receiving mental health care on her license, only to shortly thereafter take her life on the 26th of April. And it was the response by the healthcare community to her passing that led to the creation of the Dr. Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation in June of 2020 by her sister, Jennifer, my wife, and I. And I had a whole career up until that point in healthcare as an executive and as an attorney, really dedicating my professional career to actually improving the lives of the healthcare workforce. So creating this foundation, which is focused on decreasing burnout and improving well-being, and creating an environment where the workforce can thrive and feel like it is a sign of strength to obtain help, and including mental health care, was really our challenge. And we've come across a number of just incredible partners along the way, including Johnson & Johnson and the family, the extended Johnson & Johnson family, who've helped us just achieve incredible heights. But I'll leave it at that to say that's how we created the All In Initiative. Our lead partners on there were called First Responders First, which and then we have a cascade of other spanning healthcare organizations that have been involved in it. And we are trying to really make the world a little bit better place for our healthcare workforce.
So let's start just by discussing obstacles and barriers and impediments for a while. Other than an absence of the provision of mental health support, something that we'll return to in a moment, are there professional or legal bars or barriers that make it more difficult for health workers to access the kind of support that anybody else might want to support and might do so with less hesitation and greater ease and comfort?
And I assume that's still directed at me. And the answer to that is yes. And I will answer this question sheepishly because I was an attorney working inside the healthcare industry for multiple decades. I was the CEO of the organization that employed all of the physicians and all of the advanced practice professionals at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia. And yet I was unaware that these barriers existed. And there are at least six barriers to mental health access that apply to licensed health workers in the United States, most notably physicians and nurses and others like pharmacists. And those barriers, in many cases, violate a law we have in this country called the Americans with Disabilities Act. Four of the six barriers are the same issue, which is they are overreaching questions which ask about prior mental health treatment, prior mental health diagnosis, prior mental health, any formal mental health, actually, you know, care. And the concern there and the issue there is the Americans with Disabilities Act would allows employers and other licensing entities to ask about the current condition, a current impairment, whether that's physical or mental. But these questions go well beyond that, and they ask questions about, have you ever gone to a therapist, and have you ever been diagnosed? And you get the point. But these appear in licensing applications for doctors and nurses. They appear in hospital credentialing applications when you go to try to get a job at a hospital in the United States. They appear in malpractice insurance applications when you try to get covered for malpractice insurance. They can appear in applications when you try to get paid in the United States, be enrolled with a commercial insurance company and be on their panel. So those are four areas where we've observed these questions exist. And we've published a toolkit on our website at drlornabreen.org that allows organizations to go through a three-step process to change these questions. Important to that is not just changing the questions, but letting the workforce know that the changes have been made. So those are the top four. I'll quickly get to five and six, and then I'm going to loop back to one other thing. Number five is that in the United States, in many states, if a physician or a nurse is being sued for a malpractice action, the individual that is suing them can obtain through a subpoena a copy of their prior mental health record. So the ultimate insult, you're being sued for malpractice and now I'm going to go try to get all the dirt on you. It's unbelievable. It is absolutely an unbelievable state of affairs. So there are a number of states, including Virginia, who've put into place specific laws called safe haven laws that put a confidential umbrella over those medical records. And then finally, the last place where these questions that I've observed pop up, and I'm sure there are other places, and these are not questions, but this is a barrier, is that in the United States, many hospital systems provide their own health insurance to their workforce. And they pay for it out of their own costs. And so what they do is they often require their workforce to use their own health services. If they're going to be paying for it, why pay for a doctor or nurse to go to up the street to another hospital? But when they do that, they limit the access points. And what we've learned is in a number of cases where doctors have had to use the mental health services of their own institutions, that has caused them to, frankly, die by suicide. And speaking with the widow of Dr. Scott Jolly from Utah, whose only available mental health treatment for his only mental health concern of his career was his hospital, Scott was so burdened by the fact that one of his colleagues may have seen him in that inpatient unit. He died by suicide after. So these are actual regulatory barriers. And what I would share with you is two other kind of data points to just crystallize this. The first is when recently polled, almost half of the physicians in the country, when asked, why don't you obtain mental health treatment for burnout or depression, almost half of them responded by saying that they had concerns over this issue. In fact, it was the number one barrier identified by physicians to getting any mental health treatment. The second is that the American Hospital Association in October of 2022 released its first suicide prevention resource and identified in that suicide prevention resource three key drivers for suicide of the healthcare workforce in the United States. And number one is the stigma associated with the impact of your license on getting mental health treatment. So not only is this a barrier to getting mental health treatment, it has now been pointed to as a key driver of suicide of the healthcare workforce. So we have as part of our All In initiative, we have a very focused effort here on literally going state by state, licensing board by licensing board, hospital by hospital, and getting widespread adoption to this three-part toolkit. And I want to end by just saying one thing about this. It is so commonly held by the workforce that this is a barrier, that the communications that are going to be needed to clarify the current state of affairs once we get it all changed are going to be as important as making the changes themselves. And I'll point to two things for you there. The first is I mentioned that my sister-in-law died by suicide because she thought she was going to lose her license to practice medicine. She was a licensed physician in the state of New York. She had only ever worked in the state of New York and had a multi-decade career there. There are not questions on the licensing applications in New York. She was misinformed about that state of affairs. And so in this context, literally communicating the facts is life-saving. The other thing that I would just share with you, this is a very quick anecdote. I was recently teaching a number of students getting their master's in business administration about well-being programs. And I was teaching to a class, and some of the class were students who were getting their medical doctorate and their MBA at the same time. And about halfway through my teaching, one of the medical students raised his hand and he said, "You're talking about us taking care of ourselves and getting mental health treatment. I'm going to tell you right now, we will never do that because we all know we're going to lose our license if we do that." And it was just such an important moment for me to see that this concept around barriers to mental health is ingrained in students and all the way up through your practice. So we've got a long way to go, but we have a very tactical plan to eliminate these barriers, and we've got to do it.
So Stephanie, you are an emergency physician. You've practiced for many, many years. You've also found yourself at the center of efforts to promote well-being amongst healthcare professionals. And we've also been through close to once in a century pandemic, which has placed the profession both at the center of our society, but also in the eye of a hurricane of pressure and turbulence and life-saving actions and interventions. How do you think the pandemic in particular has impacted conversations around mental health in the workplace?
Thank you for that question, Paul. And I'm going to take a moment, just knock on wood, that we are experiencing a once in a century pandemic, because yeah, I think that remains an open question as time moves forward. There have been a group of people who have put themselves at the center of work around clinician professional well-being, not just in the past 3 years, but really over the past three decades. And in fact, it was October of 2019 that the National Academy of Medicine in the U.S. Released a consensus statement on professional well-being. So if you think of the timing, that was 5 months before the world sort of locked down and everyone became aware of the pandemic. So even then, there were people knocking at this door, right, and saying, this is a problem, our clinicians are suffering, not just from the occupational malaise of burnout, but also with these real challenges around mental health and suicide. So even before the pandemic, there was a movement to get recognition and action around this issue. What I saw is really two things that happened in the pandemic. And the first is that door that people had been banging on for decades started to crack open, right? And the entire world was starting to have a conversation about mental health in a little different way, a different tone, a different approach than I've seen personally in the past. And I think everyone, whether you were caring for patients, whether you had a family member who was a patient, or whether you were just watching on the news every night, you know, what patients and clinicians were going through in our hospitals and health systems with regards to the pandemic, it's had an enormous toll on the mental health of our population. And with that commonality came a new conversation and a bit of an acceptance that this is an issue. It's something that not only we can talk about, but we have to talk about. And so that door started to crack open in the medical field, which was really nice to see after years of sort of the issue being dismissed or minimalized. And now we've got people really sticking their foot in that door and saying, like, no, we're not going to let this door close again, right? This is an issue that needs to be systemically addressed, and we need operational solutions that are going to help our current state. We're not going to go back to where we were before. We're in actually a worse place now in a lot of ways, and we need to pull out of this dip and really improve things for our clinicians moving forward. So that sort of change globally in the conversation was the first thing that I've seen. And the second was it's really a double-edged sword. The first edge is the recognition of the importance of our healthcare infrastructure. You know, if you're a healthy, vital adult, right, who doesn't get sick that often, hasn't really been in the hospital or had an ill family member, it can be hard sometimes to understand the importance of the healthcare safety net and a rigorous, staffed, efficient, effective healthcare system, because you just take it for granted and you haven't had to access that. Well, in the past 3 years, many more people have had to access that, either directly themselves or indirectly through a family member or a loved one. And so there's been a new appreciation of that importance. And, you know, we saw this in the early months of the pandemic, everyone holding up signs and ringing bells and singing, you know, out their windows to honor the healthcare workers' efforts. Well, that healthcare infrastructure, which was already strained, is now in crisis, because we've seen a decline in the numbers of physicians, but especially nurses who are in practice. There have been financial stressors on hospitals and health systems throughout the pandemic, and we're seeing a further decline in that healthcare infrastructure. That should scare everybody. And so if we've got that foot in the door now, we also have another message to yell through, right? Which is not just, this is important for the health and well-being of people who have dedicated their lives and their professions to caring for others, but this is important for your own life and well-being. Because if these folks aren't here to care for you and to do a great job, that affects everyone.
So let me ask you a follow-up. I think Corey articulated something, which is you could do one systemic change organization that could bang through this issue for a decade, and I'm pretty confident you could make enormous change. Change the questions and the protocols. Don't ask invasive questions. Don't make people think that getting mental health care assistance puts you at risk in any way whatsoever. And then communicate this with complete clarity time and time and time again to give people the reassurance that the absence of legal impediments also translates into their own knowledge of where they are or aren't at risk. Clear form of action. Enormously important that there's an organization in the world that has taken up this challenge. I want to ask you a sort of subsidiary question, which is, do you think that there's something that we need to do in the curricula of medical schools which deal with how healthcare professionals perceive themselves? That there's something about people who are drawn to this profession, who put themselves first, who think about healing others before they think about healing themselves, and to give them permission psychologically, ethically, to say, taking care of myself is not just okay, it's actually a necessary part of my profession, and to hammer that home with the same degree of rigor that you hammer home the kind of diagnostic or all the other things that you do as part of your training as a physician or as a medic.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. So physicians, and to a different extent, advanced practice providers and nurses, there's some differences in the education system, but there are also some commonalities. And the commonalities, the folks who select to enter these professions, as you said, are interested in service to others. And sometimes that means that they will put the needs of others ahead of their own. And you know, on any given shift, that might look like an empty stomach and a full bladder and not enough sleep in 24 hours. And you're there to take care of your patients. But over a lifetime, what that can mean is broken relationships and a lack of balance and a non-attendance to your own needs, both physical and mental health. But it's more than the self-selection. There's also the selection criteria for medical school and the competitiveness in terms of the academic rigor and activities. When I was going through medical school, I remember my professor saying, I'm not sure I could get into medical school now with the requirements, right, for academic rigor and activity that they are. I now, Paul, I feel the same way about the young people that are getting into medical school now. And I'm blessed to have several of those folks in my life who are current medical students. And even the selection process does not value balance in terms of personal and professional pursuits. So you're taking people who are by nature self-abnegating, you're running them through a rigorous selection process, and then you're enculturating them over the course of 4 years of medical school and 3 to 8 years of residency to be ultra competitive, to mask any negative emotion or personal need that they have so that they can perform and be there for their patient. And then you tell them, make sure that you're resilient and that you take care of yourself. But everything you've told them up until that point is exactly the opposite. And so there needs to be changes at every stage, right, of that selection and education process in order to have a workforce who will care for themselves. And I'll tell you, I have a lot of hope in the generation of medical students and residents who are coming through now, who have a different relationship with mental health and mental health care than my generation and the generation that came ahead of me.
I mean, in some ways, advances on conversations around mental health are in some ways analogous to advances on conversation around sexuality and LGBTQ plus issues, where 15 or 20 years ago, enormous amount of stigma and discrimination attached. Fast forward, not to say that stigma and discrimination don't exist and we don't have a lot of work to do still, but the extent to which people can say, I'm having some mental health challenges right now. I think I need to see somebody in the same way that you would go and see somebody for a twisted ankle. And it's sort of roughly analogous. These are important advances. So I want to ask both of you a sort of a provision of care question, which is, one of the reasons I've had mixed feelings about the images you describe of people ringing bells and applauding for healthcare professionals, as much as I myself participated and as much as I myself was enormously moved by participating in those night after night and day after day here in London, and I know it happened across the globe, there was something that left me feeling a little troubled, which was the sort of empty gesture politics of it, that the sense is you could go to people and say, thank you so much for being so heroic. Now you carry on being heroic. I'm going to go indoors and have my meal with my family and leave you in the exact same structural conditions for you to continue to be a hero, other than the fact that we've clapped and you let you now know that we're jolly appreciative of everything that's happened. And so it seems to me that if you're right, that we want to take stigmatizing questions out, you want to make it clear to people, you want to increase training and awareness in medical schools, you also have to make these services easily and readily available to people when they say, gosh, I need them. And my sense is that that's a barrier as well, or not. Maybe it's just a question that they're widely abundant and people don't access them. So give us an audit, perhaps Corey first and then Stephanie, as to your assessment of the adequacy of the provision for mental health, for healthcare professionals, and what more could be done.
Well, in the 3.5 hours we have left for this podcast, I will walk you through that very diligent answer. Here's my, so not adequate, inadequate. In the United States, there are a lack of mental health professionals, period, in the United States. So to think that there is a glut of mental health professionals that can take care of the healthcare workforce would not be an appropriate extension. However, if you think about a spectrum of needs here, my observation is, and the data would show, that there's a lot that can be done through peer support programs, which are, while not formal mental health treatment, create a relationship and a conversation that can help maybe stem someone from getting all the way to needing formal mental health treatment. In the United States military, these peer support programs have really scaled and helped. Now, you were talking about, areas where there's a lot of stigma around mental health. You know, there are a number of professions, including the military and first responder culture, where this happens a lot. But peer support programs seem to be taking hold across the country right now as a proxy for this issue. They certainly do not get all the way to the mental health piece, but by training the workforce, what I think it's doing is it's also helping to create a change in the culture where people are looking out for each other. That said, there are a number of resources that popped up during the pandemic. One of my favorites is a line called the Physician Support Line. It was run by a group of physicians in the Philadelphia, Pennsylvania area, and they created a free mental health line for healthcare workforce. There are others that have popped up during the pandemic and have sustained and have basically created, on no budget or a shoestring budget, a network across the country of healthcare mental health professionals who will, step in here and take care of the healthcare workforce. So it is not because we have a formal system in this country of the right number of mental health professionals. And a lot of that has to do, well, there's a myriad of reasons for, we don't have to go there, but there's not enough. And so what I do see though, is I see us getting as far upstream of this problem as possible, starting in medical school, starting in nursing schools, creating this culture of peer support, having actual peer support programs, having confidential lines, phone lines like the physician support line or other, like in Virginia, there's this Safe Haven program, which has a confidential line. Those seem to be proliferating. As do, and Stephanie and I have a meeting with a gentleman coming up, as do these confidential group therapy sessions, basically. I mean, remember, there's such a stigma here that in order to do this work in a confidential nature is key. But this is all kind of, you know, proliferating. Whether anyone's going to get paid for any of it at any point, and which will then draw touch to the sustainability, is a different question. But right now, they have, for all intents and purposes, sustained. And as Stephanie said before, I think the need is only increasing now. And so they stood them up 2.5 years ago. They really need to continue at scale. And the last thing I would just say, and I want to come back to your medical student question before, because as you're pointing to my tactical plan, and I'm very tactical in my thinking, but one of the things that continues to come back to my head is that it is 100% predictable that when a healthcare professional goes through their career, they will see things that create trauma or triggers for them. And there is zero training that I'm aware of, or very little training in this country, when you're at that student level of how to prepare the students for it. And so as we think about creating a mental health a panacea of mental health services to support, or an infrastructure to support our healthcare workforce, we really have to think about that in the training and education component too, upstream of this, so that they can start to recognize, oh, wow, that's a colleague that is exhibiting symptoms of suicidal behavior, for example, or I am starting to, you know, have depersonalization or other things. Boy, I need to get help now, as opposed to just turn to a bottle or turn to a needle. So I think that this is, it's obviously a very complex problem. Having the mental health resources are putting a Band-Aid on it, if you will, right? We got to get upstream of it.
You know, it's interesting, Corey, that you bring up first responders, including police officers, right, military, and clinicians as three groups that really benefit from peer support. One of the things those three groups have in common is fairly unique experiences, right? Fairly unique traumatic experiences. And so there's often a real willingness to speak to someone who gets it. And that is a great entry point. And another entry point can be coaching. So coaching is not, you know, psychotherapy. It is a look forward in terms of your action and your coping mechanisms. And that can be another way to sort of extend the resources that are available for someone who is not at the point where they need professional mental health support yet. But Paul, I think your reaction of feeling like there was an emptiness to that support that happened, right? It's a wise reaction, because I'll tell you, the words that I heard from my clinician colleagues was, I appreciate the support, but what I really want is not to have to be a hero. I want to be able to be a human being who works in a system that works for me and for the patients. I want to be able to go to work and do my job to help people get better and to be healthier. And what I really want is not to have to be as resilient, right? And so there's ways we can look at that as well. So we are pretty good at measuring things in medicine, and we're very rigorous around quality. and patient experience and, you know, financial rigor around what, you know, what we're doing. We need to be including the professional well-being of our clinicians in that measurement and in those key performance indicators around quality, so that with every operational improvement we're doing, we're not just looking at the impact on quality and safety, but we're looking at the impact on the clinicians as well. And you know, the best thanks you can give someone is making their job a little easier, letting them spend a little more time with their families, or even giving them the opportunity to access the resources that are out there because they have the time to access those resources, right? And the energy.
You know, I'm struck by the fact that requiring a person to be a hero every day of their professional life, I can think of nothing that would be more taxing on your mental health than requiring that, or requiring that the pain and the trauma that you predictably and foreseeably experience in your professional life requires a heroic effort to overcome in order for you to do your job. So both of those formulations tell me that if trauma and mental health challenges are a foreseeable and predictable part of the job, to leave the dealing with that to the goodwill of a merry band of people who gather themselves together and do foundations and set up philanthropic efforts to do so outside of the system to compensate for the systemic failures is wildly important, but wholly inadequate. And so I guess it may be an entirely unfair and surprised question to ask either of you or both of you, but I guess I'd like to ask whether you can imagine any mechanism that would actually just build the financing mechanisms into what it is that is a healthcare, it is to be a healthcare professional, that there is professional schemes or hospitals pay for it, or insurance companies or healthcare providers or HMOs or the government, for, you know, most radical of all thoughts, do something to say this is essential to the provision of adequate healthcare.
So look, go ahead, Steph. She's got her hand raised. She's hot.
Well, I just wanted to frame first, you know, I'm an ER doc, so I always think in terms of airway, breathing, and circulation, right? So what we've been doing so far is holding pressure on a bleeding wound, right? It has been emergency response to an emergency situation, but it hasn't fixed the situation and it hasn't built a system that will be sustainable long-term. So I just wanted to put that framing in there because you're absolutely right. Having external groups advise is important, but having them wholly responsible is untenable. And so we need to think about, okay, now we've gotten the wound compressed, we're not bleeding anymore, how can we build in these systems? And I'm going to give one thought and then hand over to Corey. When you look for something and you measure it and you make it part of the success criteria of the organization, then the funding and support follow, right? And that may be where you can actually have a central organization, whether it's a hospital or health system that takes the initiative, or a government organization that takes an initiative, or a professional organization that takes the initiative, or yes, all of the above, to say, you need to measure this. You need to have a key performance indicator in everything that you're doing that measures the impact on clinicians of this operation. And then your reimbursement, your ability to have a hospital or health system or to practice is actually tied to that. So I think it is going to take some sort of top-down regulation, but also a bottom-up willingness to make those changes.
Corey.
Yeah. Everyone has a role in this work. Right now, our role as a foundation is to help guide and shine a big light on the issue and try to elevate organizations, areas that are working, as exemplars and celebrate them. When you think about all of the different players in the industry, what Stephanie said is brilliant and exactly right. You know, what gets measured gets moved, and what gets measured gets paid attention to. There's a new law that we helped create called the Dr. Lorna Breen Healthcare Provider Protection Act. We were in the Oval Office of the White House on March 18th, 2022, watching the President of the United States sign this first ever law, named after my sister-in-law, by the way, but the first ever law that is looking out for the well-being of the workforce. And in that law, it created an infusion of cash through programs, which we are helping to cultivate and hold up and shine and share. I think we have to come to this understanding that at the beginning, we will need infusions of capital for organizations to dedicate those resources. However, once you move this to an understanding of what really changes, I'm going to be a heretic and say there's plenty of money in healthcare to fix this, because a lot of what this is exactly what Stephanie said before. We're talking about efficient healthcare operations. We are talking about process efficiency 101 here. This is not about anything other than what everybody wants. If you're a patient, you want an efficient experience. If you're a doctor, you want an efficient experience. If you're a healthcare leader, you want an efficient. Everybody wants an efficient experience that's going to drive high quality care, right? And it's going to be at the lowest cost possible. What the thinking that we're trying to bring to this is, in order to do that, you have to recognize truly the impact of the work on the worker, because recognizing that in that process flow, you may be overly taxing the workforce for the perceived benefit of someone else needs to be balanced out. But that doesn't necessarily mean more money. In fact, a lot of time to fix, and a lot of times what you're doing is you're eliminating bureaucratic tasks. You're not actually adding to. And so what I would say to you is, we have this brand new law. We were thrilled to be a part of helping to infuse it and create it. There are already over 40 organizations in this country that are working as beneficiaries of the first round of the grants. There will be another round of those grants through our all-in work. We are also getting private funds throughout the United States and around the globe that we're allocating through a grant process. Understanding that this is still a new-ish concept, even though Stephanie has pointed out perfectly that this is not new. But the acuteness now is new. And I would just end by saying one other thing. Right now in the United States, there's an incredible healthcare workforce shortage. That workforce shortage is magnifying all these operational issues. If we don't use a pandemic plus a workforce shortage to pay attention to this issue, to finally redesign this coal mine, then we have just wasted the best opportunity we've had in hundreds of years to fix this healthcare system. And it is not, we don't have to do a wholehearted, you know, boil the ocean approach here. Very tactical, you know, as she was using the, you know, she's used the emergency medicine phrase with me before. I think about it this way. If someone's got their foot on your throat, just by taking that pressure off 10%, boy, you feel like you can run a marathon. So maybe what we're doing is we're just improving healthcare operations by 5 to 10%. And by doing that, creating an environment where the workforce can thrive to enable them to take best care of patients. I think that's what we're trying to do here.
So Stephanie, I want to ask, the image of you, you know, dealing with airways or compressing a wound, or took me to this image of you in an emergency room administering care under high pressure to people in desperate need of that assistance. And then the end of a very long shift, feeling that you yourself need some assistance. And then what it conjured in my mind is, what would that actually look like suited to doctors in their real, very busy lives who want to get home to their families or want to be able to get 5 hours sleep, let alone 8 hours sleep, and then keep themselves brushed up on all the latest discoveries and technologies and medical advances and have their own professional development and then have a balanced normal life and healthy relationships and everything like that. So is the model to be able to have a person who is your own dedicated resource that you can sit down with in a therapeutic mode that we might associate with other forms of traditional therapy? Is it peer-to-peer support groups? Is it online access for quick questions? Is it periodic, continuous professional education like lawyers have to go through where you're required to kind of check in? What would it actually look like? And how would you, to use Corey's word about sort of, let's get tactical, what are some specific things that you think we could do that would actually make a difference?
Well, my answer to your question is yes. It's all of those things. And there's probably not a one-size-fits-all approach, right? Different people respond to different types of relational support. And for many, having a friend at work that you can call is the first line of sort of their mental health defense. And one of the things that's happened with the change in the healthcare workforce is those teams, which are often as much like families as teams, right? A group of nurses and doctors and techs and clerks who have worked together for 15 years and really gone through the grinder together, they're not together anymore. Those teams and those families have been split apart as part of the workforce turned over. So those ingrained and embedded peer supporters that sort of occurred naturally need to be supported by other programs. And at the very least, there needs to be a pool of people available when a clinician reaches out. When you self-identify, I've had a bad outcome, I'm getting sued, I've just seen something horrific, and I need someone to talk to. At the very least, there needs to be a pool of people who have some training and peer support and are able to do that. As a backstop to that, there are some times when peer support isn't appropriate, where someone is not just needing to talk to a friend or someone who gets it or share their experience, but they need professional support. And so having 24-hour professional support available is key. And that's tricky because a lot of times due to state practice laws, you actually have to have a mental health clinician that practices in the same state as you, which means if you're getting off of your shift at 3 a.m., right, in the morning, that can be, the well-trained mental health clinicians who are able to provide support are pretty scant on the ground at that hour of the night. But the hospitals don't close. They're open 24 hours and bad things happen often on off hours. And so having those rigorous backup supports are important. Continuous medical education does include information about how to manage personal stressors. And we are aware of and are working with several organizations that are looking at continuous medical education around personal resilience and stress management in a different way, right? In a way that recognizes that they already are dealing with an incredibly strong, resilient workforce, and just building their resilience is not the answer, right? Because it's really saying, okay, I know you're already carrying 2 tons of steel on your back, right? We're going to be adding another ton over the next year, and so we want you to get stronger. Well, that's not appropriate. It's not an appropriate ask, right? The appropriate ask is we're going to put someone else under this load with you so you can share the load, and then we're going to take some weight off the top, right? And so that's really what we need to be doing for folks, is making sure that they've got plenty of people pulling alongside them who are on their teams and who are available to them, and that we're lightening the load along the way. So having continuous medical education that focuses that on that type of resilience is really critical.
So we've come to the top of the hour, and what I think you have both done with incredible clarity and eloquence, I must say, is make the case for the Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation, of why you exist, why you get up every day, the work that you're doing. And you are responding not to an imagined challenge, but a real world one. And you have a ton of work to do. So in 30 seconds each, no more, tell us how people can help you. What can they do if listeners have listened to this and feel moved to want to assist? What can they do?
The number one thing they can do is contact us and support our work through the Dr. Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation. We have created an infrastructure now and partnerships where we are already touching millions of health workers in this country. So contact us at drlornabreen.org. We have a toolkit that you can utilize to start this work locally, become an ambassador for us, and help us spread this work so that we can help change healthcare and really heal healthcare so that the healthcare workforce can do the best job that they train to do to take care of patients.
So I'm going to speak to my colleagues out there in healthcare professions, because what Corey said is absolutely true. But I also want to speak to our doctors and our nurses and our techs and our clerks and our environmental service workers there in the hospitals and clinics around the world. And what I want them to hear is that there is an unprecedented alliance of people in all sorts of organizations and in all walks of life who are pulling behind this effort in recognition of the work that you are doing every day and the stresses that you are facing. And there's hope in that for change for the future. And so my ask of them is to hold on to that hope dearly. And if they're experiencing a mental health crisis, if they need someone to talk to, take that first step and reach out and countermand that training and that culture and make that first step for themselves and for their teams.
And possibly just to reframe things in very simple ways, the best possible way you could be of assistance to others is to be of assistance to yourself. And if you view it in those ways, you are helping other people by helping yourself. Simple. And you guys are at the forefront of enabling, turning that from a simple self-evident truth into real-world policies and actions. And for that, I think we're all enormously grateful. I've enormously enjoyed our conversation, and I congratulate you on your extraordinarily important work.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations in partnership with the Johnson & Johnson Center for Health Worker Innovation. Please do subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. For more information about The Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.